LocalTheaterNY.com is where theater lives, and this is the podcast that helps bring it to life with behind-the-scenes interviews of the people who make theater happen, shares what's hot, who is hot, what's playing, what's opening, and what you can't miss in the New York tri-state area. Today, Monday, July 13th, as three major theater festivals open up in the New York City area, we bring to you the Thespis Theater Festival, the largest of the three, offering 60 shows and running into October of 2015. And in doing so, we introduce you to Dr. Carol W. Berman, a playwright, psychiatrist, and artist who has written a play called Parking Lot 63. And today joins us for an insightful interview you don't want to miss. This is episode 12. Carol W. Berman, you have written a play for the Thespis Festival, which is called Parking Lot 63. We're excited to hear about it, but more excited to hear about you. You are a doctor, an artist, a painter, and a playwright, and this is not your first play. You've written a few plays, but I'm very interested in knowing first for our audience a little bit about you. Tell us about your background and how you got into playwriting.
Well, I'm a psychiatrist, and I'm over at NYU Medical Center. I'm a clinical assistant professor there. But I got into playwriting in about 2000 because I lived around the corner from the neighborhood playhouse on the east side in the 50s. And one day they had a special gala presentation. So I went over there, and they had a party that I was invited to. And I started talking to the artistic director, Harold Baldrige, and his wife was giving a playwriting course the next month. So that was January 2000. So I took that course. That was the beginning of my playwriting career, although I've been a writer my whole life. I was a writer before I was a doctor. I have two nonfiction books. I just got a contract to do a third one. I also write fiction. So writing has been something I've done my whole life. In terms of being an artist, I love that, and I'm doing that too.
Now, was this like a spur-of-the-moment thing? You had the background in terms of writing, but did you all of a sudden say, wow, I'd like to try playwriting? And how many plays have you written since then?
I've written six plays, and this is my sixth one, Parking Lot 63. And it's not a spur-of-the-moment. As soon as I started seeing theater, which was way back when I was a teenager, I loved theater. I fell in love with theater like a lot of people. I became starstruck. And I said, I love it. And since I can't do acting or any of that part, as a writer, I could do playwriting. So I got into that.
Yeah, it's always fascinating to me how like that kind of sits in there in your being, and you want to do and you want to do. And that day comes along when the opportunity sort of presents itself. And tell us about some of the plays you've written. What are the different things you've written about?
The first play I wrote was called Under the Dragon. Was about a psychiatrist being stalked by her patient. And that one was based on a real story, not my story, thank God, but another story. And it has a happy outcome, but it was kind of a dark play. Then I wrote a play called Sunshine Sally, which is about the 60s, and a woman from the West Coast comes to the East Coast, and she tries to fit in with New York policies. That's kind of a little bit autobiographical. And then the next one I wrote was Professional Misconduct, about a doctor who goes crazy in his own emergency room, and he's taken to the psych ward, and then any doctor who's on the psych ward has to, go up against the board that wants to take his license away. That was based on a true story. And then I did Brownstone Breakdown, which was about a mafioso landlord taking over Brownstone in Midtown on the east side. I won't tell you if that's autobiographical or not. I don't want to get knocked off. And, this is a big issue that people are facing right now because the rent control laws are up for,
that's right.
You know.
So a lot of your plays are based on something that you've seen or experienced. Obviously, a little bit of your career is kind of mixed in there. And that's always a fascinating. I mean, playwrights write what they know about. Now we come to this particular play, which is really fascinating because it has a very strong social, I don't want to say message as theme. It has a theme. And so why don't you tell us about Parking Lot 63, tell us a little background of the story and how it came about, and tell us what that social theme is.
Well, Parking Lot 63 takes place in 1963. That's why it's called Parking Lot 63. And it's actually based on some family events that I went through because I grew up in L.A. in the early 60s. And it's about child abuse. It's about sexual slavery. It's about a lot of different issues. And that was a time of great change in the 60s when we baby boomers kind of broke away from all authority figures and we started living a different kind of life. And I was a kid at that time, and I started experiencing so many different things. And the world changed at that point. And I wanted to capture just a moment in time with this play and, you know, bring it to the public and get these issues. I like social issues, but I know that you can't stand on a soapbox and lecture to people about social issues. Nobody wants to hear. But if you tell a story and people are captured by that story, they'll get into these social issues.
Drawing in people on an emotional level to bring a social issue to light, something that's really not done on Facebook, really. I mean, Facebook attempts, you know, all the social media attempts to show little video clips and things like that. But when you sit in the theater, you really become embraced by the story and by the characters. Tell us about the story and tell us about the characters and why we're going to be embraced by this subject matter.
Well, we have six characters. We have the heroine of the story is a 13-year-old girl. And I have a wonderful actress who's 14 who's actually going to play it. And then it's her big brother, who she idolizes, and her parents. Now, the father works in a parking lot. That's one of the reasons it's called Parking Lot 63. And he's a guy who's kind of a rough guy, working class man. And then the mother's a rough person, too. And they're both coming from Brooklyn, New York, and they go to L.A. So it's a huge change for them in terms of, you know, East Coast to West Coast. And then they're trying to blend in with different people. And they're weird people. They're vegetarians, which didn't happen too much at that time. And the daughter, Sarah, who's the heroine, she's trying to adapt to her new environment in California. And yet she's under a lot of abuse. She's under sexual abuse. She's under physical abuse. Her big brother, who's a genius physicist, is trying to protect her and help her. And the two children bond, and they're working against the parents, who are quite cruel. And so in a way, it's kind of like a Cinderella story, too.
How long did it take you to write the play? When did you start it? And how much has it changed? And talk about the process, because a festival show is a very unique animal.
Well, I started the play about 3 years ago. I was in a playwriting group called Characters, Inc., and the woman who ran the group asked us a question. And she said, what was the most embarrassing thing in your life? And so I started thinking about that, and I figured out the most embarrassing thing in my life was when I was a child trying to adapt to L.A. culture. Here I was from Brooklyn. And I realized I had to tell people. They said, what did your father do for a living? And I was in an upper-middle-class school, public school, but upper-middle-class. And they said, what did your father do for a living? My father was a parking lot attendant, and that's what he did for a living. He was a working-class man, and so was my mother. And I had to say that, and then I was very embarrassed by it because everybody had doctors and lawyers and upper-middle-class people for parents, but I didn't. But I guess that's why I became all these things, because I had to overachieve.
That usually is what happens, right?
Yeah.
So you started the play 3 years ago. Do you see it changing as you're rehearsing?
It changes all the time. Like, I have a very good director, Kristen Omantra Callahan, and she's taking it upon herself to interpret it and just auditioning different people for the parts. I saw so many different actors, and each one interpreted the lines differently. And it's amazing to see other people take this play and run with it and give it a new life. The director's giving it a new life, and so are the actors. Now, we have our whole cast. We're going to start rehearsals, and it's so exciting to see these people. I can't imagine the way they take it in all these different directions, but it's beautiful to see them and to see them run with the characters. And I think the characters are written in a way that it gives them enough room to run in many different directions with and bring it to life.
So prior to our conversation our interview here, we talked about some of the numbers, and they're quite shocking. And I know that the play is not about spewing numbers to the audience, otherwise that would be terribly, defeat the purpose of the emotional capture. But you did say some very shocking things about sexual slavery. Why don't you share that with our audience?
Right. I read that 21 to 30 million boys and girls, children today, are being held as sexual slaves. And something like 83% of victims of sex trafficking in the USA are U.S. citizens, which I thought was shocking, because we always think it's, people grabbed from Mexico or other countries and, put into slavery. But actually, 83% of them are U.S. citizens, and these boys and girls are being used against their will, and these horrible pimps are, putting them out on our streets in New York City. And, we got to put a stop to this for sure. And my play kind of gets us into those issues.
You really don't hear about prostitution or about sexual slavery a lot. In fact, I have to say that not much. Why do you think that is? And you know, what can be done to bring attention to this incredible issue?
Well, I heard a very good lecture at the JCC right here on the Upper West Side, and they had a district attorney, they had a social worker, and a psychologist who are into these topics, and they were lecturing about this, and they said, we don't hear about it much, and they're trying to bring it out into the public domain, but I don't know why people are not interested in it. I think we're in denial about these horrible things that happen right on our streets and in our apartments around town.
Do you think that this new mentality that this country has, that we have as a country towards, let's say, the legalization of marijuana, or the legalization of this or that, the issue of legalization of prostitution has come up, and it's legal in some places. Do you think we're sort of giving up on this?
Well, it's very difficult with the idea of prostitution because most prostitutes actually have been abused as children.
Right.
So you have to think, you know, these people are going, some people go into it voluntarily, I'm sure, but then a lot of people have been coerced into it, a lot of people have been abused, and like a sexual abuse victim can go either way. They could become a nun where they're not into sexuality, or they could go into prostitution where they already had sexuality since they're children, and they're going in both directions. So in terms of legalizing it, I don't know if that's a good idea. I haven't really thought about that, but that is a good question.
I remember when I was younger, back in the 80s and the 70s, where, you know, ABC and NBC would have these cutting-edge movies about prostitution and maybe about, you know, some sort of sexual abuse. You don't really see that much. How do you hope that your play will bring light to that and bring that issue to, you know, to the forefront?
Well, in my field in psychiatry, we see a lot of sexual abuse victims, and something like 70% of psychiatric patients have been sexually abused. And I think the numbers are with women, the numbers are 1 out of 3 girls have been sexually abused, and with boys, it's like 1 out of 4 or something like that. And, you know, it's incredible that so many people have had this, and yet the whole society is in denial about it. I think it's just coming out. You know, it used to be you could never talk about these things. But you're right, in the 70s and 80s, they had programs about it. And now we've gone back into denial, and we're talking about other topics. But it is prevalent throughout psychiatric patients. And, you know, I'm working with different people every day to just get them to live a normal life. So I'm hoping that my play could bring some of these issues to the forefront, and people can survive sexual abuse or even sexual slavery and go on to do wonderful things with themselves. But I don't think society should deny it so much, because it's all over the place, and it's horrible to see people afterwards trying to deal with it and their lives destroyed in many ways. They need therapy, of course, afterwards, and to get back into society.
What are some of the other subjects, just to change gears here a little bit, what are some of the other subjects that you cover in your play? What are some of the other themes? I mean, tell us about the story itself a little.
Well, the story is about a dysfunctional family, and my heroine is this 13-year-old girl, how she overcomes some of the dysfunction of the family. The father is quite immature, and the mother is not up to her role as a mother. And, you know, it's hard to be a family. It's hard to be a mother and father. It's hard to be a child in such a family. It's about family dysfunction, but a specific story at a specific time.
Now, 1963, that's a really unique time in history. I mean, a lot of things begin to happen around that time, you know, going into the 60s. How have you seen things change in terms of family dysfunction and just family life since 1963 to today, 2015?
Well, it used to be in the 50s and 60s that the parents were the authority on everything and people really listened to them. But I think it was my generation, the baby boomer generation, that we stopped listening to authority. And authority was corrupt in many ways, and we started seeing through that. We broke away from that. We stopped the Vietnam War. We did all kinds of things. And you see, the respect for authority is completely different now, and it started with the baby boomers. And we pushed away from that. And in my story, the main character breaks away from her family because they're authorities, but they're not good authorities. They don't really do the right thing in a lot of ways. So that's when that started happening. Kennedy was assassinated at that time. It was a big shock to the nation because we loved him. And then all of a sudden that happened. And then we thought we're going to get nuked any minute. It was the Cold War with Russia. Yeah. So they actually had us hiding under desks so that we wouldn't get nuked, which was ridiculous. But my generation thought, okay, we're going to be nukes, so we might as well have fun. And then came drugs, sex, and rock and roll, everything else, because we thought, well, we're not going to live too long. We did, but we're not going to live too long. We're going to get nuked. So that began a big change at that time.
You've done a few other plays. How is this play different from some of the others? What are you looking at in terms of this production that you're seeing is already different? Because I know you're very passionate about this particular play.
Well, this is a different play. Now, I've done my whole life in plays. I'd say that I started at when I did Under the Dragon, which was about a psychiatrist being stalked by a patient. It wasn't about me, but it was about that time period when I was that age in 2000. And then now I've gone all the way back to childhood to take a look at that. And I think that this play is different. I have a different director. I have a different point of view. I'm kind of recovering my roots in a way. And I have great hopes for this play because I love this festival. But we only have 90 minutes to do the play. Yes. So that's different because we're cut into time and we're part of like 60, 70 plays. So this has to be the best play I ever did to get some recognition. Yeah.
Walking into the rehearsal process, what things do you see as must happen in terms of the characters, in terms of the storytelling? I mean, how flexible are you to really, you know, change your story if it comes to that, if the direction comes to that?
Well, hopefully it won't come to that because I think Kristen understands my play very well and she's trying to follow the lines that I've written. But we have a big challenge in that we have to get a bunch of things on the stage. We have to have the parking lot. We don't have time to change scenery that much. We have to have the bedroom. We have to have the living room. So I think I have a good set designer who's going to put it all on stage at once and then we're going to put different lighting depending where we are. And we got to move fast. We've got that period of time, and people tell me I should write for films because my scenes are very fast.
Was that done on purpose or because you're trying to put a lot into the story? How would you say the layout worked out?
Well, I'm trying to put a lot into the story, but I had to cut a lot to get it to that amount of time. And then I'm trying to develop the characters as fully as possible. Like you might think the father is an evil guy because of his behavior, but I wanted to show why he does what he does. Like, why does a child molester do that? I wanted to show his personality, his psychology. And he's a very complicated man. He's just simply not an evil person. I mean, it's evil to do child abuse, but this is a very complicated character, and so is the mother. And you might think of them, oh, they're just evil people. No, they're complicated, intricate people like most human beings.
You know, one of the things that's different from 1963, to today is that now there are places where people can go and kind of voice their pain, their terror, their concerns, things like that. What's out there for people who are suffering from, you know, sexual slavery, sexual abuse, maybe want to get out of prostitution? Where can they go to sort of help themselves or change their direction?
Well, for child abuse victims, we have many self-help groups. You could call 311, actually, in New York City and ask where to go. And a patient of mine just went to a child abuse group. He's in his 50s, but he's ready to talk about it with a group. So there are public groups like that. There are private groups that you could join. There are so many psychologists, social workers, psychiatrists throughout the city. If you feel that you can't take it anymore, you could go to any local emergency room, and you know you'll be directed to somebody in your neighborhood who could help you. And there's so much that we could do to help people. And sexual slavery, if you're walking on the street and you see a boy or a girl or some person that you feel is like coerced into this, you could call 911 and call the police, and they will take that person out of there, hopefully cooperating with everybody, and save that person from it. Because a lot of times people are right in the neighborhood and other people don't realize it. But if you call the police, sometimes it'll break up whatever group it is.
What do you foresee, or what kind of things are you expecting from your actors, and how will they handle this very touchy subject from your perspective? What do you think will happen?
Well, when I was casting the role of the 13-year-old girl, Sarah, we actually have a 14-year-old girl, and the father was with her, and we said to the father, please read the script and make sure that it's okay for her to play this part. And then, you know, he read it. He said, okay, she's not going to actually be touched or anything. We said, don't worry, that won't happen.
Right.
And then I said, don't worry, I'm a psychiatrist. I'll help her whatever way I can. And then, no, people have to get into this head of the character. And then the man who's playing the father, actually one guy dropped out. He said, I can't see myself playing a role like that. It's going to take me to places that I don't want to go in my head. And then the one who's playing it, he said, I could do it. I could do it. It won't hurt me. So I'm looking out for the mental health of my actors, and any problems they have, they could come to me. But it's funny how sometimes actors will get in a role and it'll leave a lasting impression on them, and then hopefully it doesn't hurt them any, because they have to go through a lot of emotional strain to produce these characters and to get into the heads of these characters.
What are your expectations of the people who come see the show? What kind of an emotional... I don't want to use the word hook, but emotional connection with this show and with these performances and the story have with them. And what's your hope of what will happen afterwards?
Well, I hope people will be able to relate to the characters very much, because it's a family and we all come from different families. Some of us come from good families, some come from bad families, but we all come from a family. And hopefully people will be able to relate to this family and be able to relate to my main character and how she goes through all this stuff and she survives and she's a winner at the end.
So, Carol, let's talk about your expectations for this play after the festival. Your show opens up in the middle of August. It's going to run for, you know, three performances?
Exactly.
And then what happens afterward? Where would you like this show to go and why?
I would like this show to go off Broadway, and I'd love it to go on Broadway. I guess every author feels that. But, you know, I've seen a lot of stuff on Broadway, and besides Fun House, I haven't seen too many other good plays. But Fun House was really deep, good, wonderful play about a person's childhood and how she came out of it and she survived it. Now, my play runs August 13th at 9 p.m., August 15th at 1 p.m., and August 16th at 6 p.m.
This is a really big theater. It's a nice space, the Hudson Guild, right?
Oh,
how's that feel?
That feels really good. It's at 441 West 26th Street, and it's excellent. You know, those 3 dates, August 13, 15, and 16, be sure to come. And it feels great to have such a big space and have such good actors and a good director. I'm thrilled to death.
Well, Carol, I wish you the best. As they say, break a leg and really enjoy this process. I think it's going to be a very good experience for everyone involved. We're looking forward to the play. It'll be listed on localtheaterny.com. It'll be listed on the Thespis website. And we wish you the best of luck. Thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you so much, Roger. It's been a pleasure.
Have a wonderful summer while you rehearse.
Okay. Thank you.
And that's it for today's podcast. Please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. A special thank you to today's sponsor, Theater Marketing Insights, also on iTunes. If you like our show, we ask that you leave a comment on iTunes and let us know what you think. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and visit our site to sign up for our mailing list. Or email me directly at localtheaterny@gmail.com. Remember, that's theater, R-E, not E-R. Signing off, here's to encores and standing ovations. I'm Roger Gonzalez. This podcast is the copyrighted property of Alliance Media and Communications 2015. All rights are reserved.